Hands for the Arts.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, 40 years ago, this Saturday, M&F received in the mail a postcard from the Federal Communications Commission, giving it the okay to broadcast full-time 24 hours a day. The previous summer, in the summer of 1979, we did test broadcasts. M&F came out of the idea of a USF student who was very angry that WUSF had taken off the student-led programming in 1975 and 76 called Underground Railroad. Today, we're going to hear a documentary about the history of the founding of WM&F, and later in this hour, we'll open up the phone lines. First, two listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we talked a little bit about 9/11. We got these comments after the show was over.
It's in St. Peter. First, the young people, if they want a secure and safe future, they're going to have to get out and they're going to have to vote Democrat, because Republicans, they're not going to do anything about gun control, and that's that. And between 94 and 2004, assault weapons were banned, and how many rounds you could get in a magazine were banned, and nobody came for the rest of your guns, and that's going to happen again. Nobody's coming for your guns. And I was reflecting on 9/11, and I remember at the time I was listening to just a music station back in 2001, and some guy called in and said that a terrorist may choose the way you're going to die, but he's not going to choose the way you're going to live. And that always stuck with me. You just need to live your life and do your thing. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Bad things happen all the time. But we all have to learn not to live in fear.
Hi, my name is Juan Fowler. On 9/11, 18 years ago, I served as an EMT in Ground Zero, along with other firefighters, police officers, EMTs. We didn't have time to worry about what smelled or how things looked. We just went in there to rescue people. The only thing that I knew is that there were other neighbors of ours, countrymen of ours, that were in need of help. And that's all I can remember. Other than that, I want to wish you and all the listeners a beautiful day.
Some listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. Well, this week, WM&F has begun the celebration of its 40th year on the air. And right now on WM&F, we're going to play a documentary that was produced some years ago by Sheila Cowley, our operations director at the time, about the founding of WM&F. We're going to hear the story of M&F's founding next for the next half hour. And then later on in this program, I'm going to open up the phone lines and ask you what initially attracted you or made you bond with WM&F? What was it that made you like WM&F? We'll talk about that. There's a lot of people who've already sent in answers to that question on Facebook, and you can send your answer into that to dj@wmnf.org. Now, the documentary about the founding of WM&F 40 years ago.
Woke up this morning, put on my slippers, in the kitchen and
dive. Coming home late at night, listening for something on the radio, flipping through the channels, and I come across this left end of the dial, and I hear this "Please Burn Down the Cocoa Ground." I thought, what in the heck is this stuff? And I started listening, and I found out it was air checks for WM&F.
Driving home from the late shift, Tampa Bay Area resident Mike Handley enjoyed hearing WM&F's first successful air checks. The air checks were just one of many hurdles to jump before WM&F officially went on the air, September 14, 1979. Starting a community radio station is not a flip of a switch. Nearly 5 years of labor went into creating WM&F before those early test broadcasts were even possible. From finding a place on the dial, to acquiring costly broadcast equipment, and gathering community support. Hi, I'm Sheila Daughtry, and you're listening to the story of how WM&F Community Radio got on the air. During this program, you'll hear from a few of the many people who gave their heart and soul to this grassroots project on door-to-door donations, idealism, and sheer persistence.
There's a guy named Arnie Shalansky that originally undertook to build the station. Arnie Shalansky was a student at Antioch University, Antioch of Ohio, you know where all the politically suspect radicals come from.
Ed Miller was a Vista volunteer in Ohio when he heard about a community radio station starting up in Tampa.
Arnie Shalansky had read this book, Sex and Broadcasting, which is no longer published, which has nothing to do with sex and everything to do with broadcasting. It is a cookbook on how to build your own radio station.
I had to start a corporation, a nonprofit foundation, had to get a board of directors together of community leaders, which meant meeting the right people and all of that. We did the frequency search, and I had to do some formal things with that. We had to find space to permission to put up an antenna on somebody's radio tower, so that meant going to all the different radio and TV stations until we found somebody that would willingly allow us to use their tower. We had to put together all the formal things to do with what kind of equipment we were going to use, what kind of transmitter.
The process Shalansky was following was laid out in Sex and Broadcasting, the how-to book written by community radio pioneer Lorenzo Milam. Milam was instrumental in starting a number of stations around the country and invited Shalansky to come to Tampa and start a radio station.
We had to get a file with the Internal Revenue Service for a tax-exempt status so that people could donate money to the foundation. And we had to put together a whole projected itinerary of what was going to be done on the air, what kind of programming we were going to have and all of that. And then finally submit what was probably about 80-page application to the FCC.
Nathan B. Stubblefield was a guy that Arnie Shalansky and Lorenzo Milam, you know, revered because he was a very early broadcast engineer. He was a guy who came up with the idea, actually, for the television set, the rasters and the cathode ray tube was one of his early concepts. His idea was radio you could see. So that's who Nathan B. Stubblefield was. And they set up the Nathan B. Stubblefield Foundation. And the Nathan B. Stubblefield Foundation was granted the frequency of 88.5, which was in danger of being awarded to some fundamentalist religious station or some other horrific fate in our viewpoint. So they had the station, or they had the frequency.
Choosing the station's call letters was another hard task.
I listed about 10 or 12, you know, going through the dictionary, looking up W's, you know, things start with a W. And way down at the very bottom of the list, just kind of as a joke, I put down WINO. And I get it back from the FCC a few months later, and sure enough, that's the one that they had given me. So it was WINO Radio. After thinking about it and discussing it with some people, we decided that if we had to raise funds from the public, that might be a little bit of a problem. They might not take us seriously.
The search for a serious ID turned into a blizzard of paperwork that continued well after Arnie Shalansky left the scene. A look at scrawled documents reveals hundreds of possibilities. WMNF was finally chosen, standing for member-sponsored, non-commercial FM.
Now, actually going on the air and starting broadcasting, I never did actually get to see it go on the air. It had been 3 years that I had been working on it, and I was starting to get burnt out, and I had family things to take care of up in New York. So at that time, I met Wade Rathke from ACORN, which was an organization out of Little Rock, Arkansas.
ACORN stood for Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, a nonprofit entity working with low to moderate income communities. ACORN strived to make media more accessible by putting community radio stations on the air.
So what, in fact, Arnie did is turn it over to Wade, and Wade put Joe Fox on the job. Joe Fox was the guy to really get things done.
I thought we were going to be on the air in a couple months. We all thought that that things were going to happen a lot more quickly than they did. None of us had a realistic idea of the amount of time it was going to take on the front end. And it dragged on and on. I mean, I got down there in, I want to say, end of January 78, and we went on the air in September 79. We had a construction permit from the SEC, and there was really nothing else. There was no equipment, there was no money, there was no location. We had to start by hiring some staff, looking for equipment, raising money.
Ed Miller saw Joe's ad in the Vista newsletter. He showed up in Tampa on a hot February day and found the office WMNF shared with ACORN, a bare-bones storefront across from the University of Tampa, which had previously been used by Scientologists, and before that, had been a pornography studio.
You know, I got there and I said, well, you know, what's going on, Joe? And he goes, well, we're in the fundraising stage. We're raising money. And then he began to tell me that we're going to be going door-to-door and canvassing. And I about took his head off. I said, you mean to tell me I drove down, 900 miles from Ohio to go door-to-door and raise money for a radio station that has no funding and no equipment and very few prospects of getting on the air? And he goes, calm down. I'll tell you what the plan is. He was very, he laid out the plan. And he was a very convincing guy, very charismatic guy when he wanted to be. And I decided to stick around. I gave it a week. I said, okay, I'll give it a week, And we went and we stayed in this big communal house on Rome Avenue in Hyde Park. And there were like 16 people staying there that night. And Joe baked cookies. He baked these oatmeal cookies. And we all kind of sat around eating oatmeal cookies and drinking coffee and talking about our prospects. And then we all sort of bedded down wherever there was space on the floor and spent the night. But, there were two or three of those houses that eventually filled up with WMNF refugees as they all drifted in. And everybody went through the same process. It was like they got there. Joe had somehow talked to these people. I mean, these were talented people who had backgrounds in business or in broadcasting or in politics. And they're young. We were all in our 20s, early 20s. And they'd come driving in these claptrap automobiles. They'd get to Tampa, they kind of squint up at the sun and go to it and say, well, where's the radio station? And he goes, well, there's a couple of things I want to go over with you.
I was living at home, and I saw an ad in Mother Jones magazine for a radio station that was starting up in Florida, and they needed all sorts of people. They needed people to be the program director and to be the development director and all this stuff.
Robert Lori, another early WMNF refugee looking for a career in radio.
So I sent my resume down in a cover letter and said that I had already worked at the college station in Ohio, and it was an NPR station. It also had a whole lot of community aspects to it. And I wrote him a letter and said I'd already done this, and I'd like to come down to Florida to work. And sure enough, they hired me. So I came down in the summer of 1978.
78, October 15th, right? I think it was smack dab in the middle of October. Because I started October 1st, I think it was, up at Chapel Hill for the canvassing training with Carolina Action, and then was to report for duty here October 15th.
Running from up Wisconsin way down to no man's land.
Cameron Dilley was living out in San Francisco when he got a call from a friend who told him Acorn was starting a radio station in Tampa, Florida. Acorn sent Cam to a two-week training session in North Carolina, where he learned how to canvass, or sell an idea to a total stranger in less than 2 minutes. After the crash course, Dilley drove 15 hours straight to Tampa.
He just appeared at the front door one morning, knocked on the door about 8 o'clock, and I got up, and there was Cam Dilley, and he said, I'm Cameron Dilley, I'm lost and exhausted. And I said, well, come on in. You came to the right place. And I remember I made him Cuban coffee first thing, and that woke him right up.
And scrambled eggs and Cuban toast. I think that was my first real Tampa Cuban breakfast. And then we went to a park and played Frisbee, and I kind of got introduced to the folks that were in town for this thing.
Training in North Carolina proved worthwhile. He became the lead fundraiser in the struggle to raise seed money. With grant money tight and on-air fundraising an impossibility, the handful of staffers took to the streets, selling residents on the idea of a community radio station and asking for donations.
I said, okay, well, when do we start work? And they said, well, this afternoon we're going to go out and knock on doors. And I said, what? Yeah, we're going to go knock on doors. One of the staff people told me. And I'd kind of been led to believe that there was some money to operate the radio station, but that wasn't the case. The way the radio station was going to finance itself in the early days was going door to door. So we went out that afternoon. It was a hot summer afternoon. I think it was raining. And they dropped me in some neighborhood in Pinellas County, and they said, okay, ask these people for money. So I was in Florida barely 24 hours, and I was knocking on doors, and I was asking people to support a radio station that didn't exist. And in the back of my mind, I thought, it's never going to exist.
We were really obsessed with trying to raise money, and we weren't that good at it. I mean, a lot of us didn't really cotton to the canvassing, going door to door. You got to put up with an awful lot of rejection because you're getting no from, you know, at least 9 out of 10 households. You know, you react when some stranger's knocking on your door looking for money, and we would say,
hi, I'm from WMNF Radio in Tampa, and we're the folks that are starting a community radio station, and we're going to play all sorts of music, bluegrass and folk and jazz and all sorts of music that you can't hear on the radio. And we plan to be on the air in the next few months. And if you'd like to make a donation now, you could be one of those people that helped get us going. Mm-hmm. You make a pitch like that. And most people, like I said, had never heard of community radio. Occasionally you'd find somebody who had lived in New York or maybe lived in Philadelphia or Berkeley, and they'd know exactly what you were talking about, and they'd give you $20 or $10 or whatever.
Rob and the others were also raising their own salaries. Project leader Joe Fox.
It was, I'm sure, a little bit intimidating for a staff person to be hired and then be told, well, you have to canvass to raise your own salary, and if you can't raise enough money for your salary, then we can't pay you.
We were selling a non-existent product. We had nothing really to show except some printed material about what we would do. And we basically tried to get our foot in the door by saying, well, what kind of music do you like? And whatever they said, I mean, if it was polka or classical or alternative rock or reggae or whatever it was they liked, well, we're going to have that. We believed in what we were doing, and I think the reason a lot of us were, that we were all able to be successful with the canvassing, was that we had something that really struck a chord with people, that there was a definite niche there. There was a void to fill in the area of opening up the airwaves to just regular folks, alternative music and alternative points of view and things that just weren't offered in the commercial airwaves, was something that really did strike a chord with a lot of people. And in fact, there are a lot of volunteers and people here in the area that still remember the day that somebody, one of those original 7 or 8 of us, came and knocked on their door and talked about this radio station that was going to come on the air anytime now, and did they want a membership. And I think like Cheryl Mogul, who does the reggae show on Saturdays, was one of the first people that ever got canvassed.
We were hanging in the yard on De Leon, just one house in from Boulevard, South Boulevard, in a real neat old $80 a month apartment, and two guys came up to us. We were sunbathing in the yard, and they said, told us about this new radio station, and I said, it sounds pretty good. And I said, well, you know, so I gave him $5, I believe.
We started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, went until 9 o'clock at night. You know, we went to specific areas, we had maps laid out, we went door to door, we tried to hit, you know, 40-50 places a night, and we had a quota that we tried to raise. The quota was, I think, $70.
You know, I'd come home with 8 new memberships, 100 or 7 new memberships, $150 or $140. Those were the nights when you just said, wow, this is terrific. Then there were the nights when you came home with $35 for 3 hours of canvassing, and you thought, why am I doing this? This is crazy. This is no way to raise money for a radio station.
A lot of the responses were very skeptical, to say the least, when you'd knock on a door. I mean, we got accused of being all kinds of things. I actually got arrested in Safety Harbor or Palm Harbor, one of those communities, was arrested by a very nice cop, by the way. He was a retired policeman from New York City, who thought it was kind of funny that these people would be intimidated by a community radio canvasser. But it was illegal. I was technically not supposed to be at an ordinance or something against any kind of soliciting or door-to-door canvassing in that area. So I spent that night cooling my heels in the police car waiting for everybody else to come back from across the border of Bel Air Heights or whatever it was, whatever that community was over there.
Conditions for the staff were not the Ritz. They subsisted on a salary of roughly $70 a week. Part-time jobs, on top of 12-hour days of radio work, were necessary to survive.
It was very bare bones. We were living communally, sort of eating one or two meals a day. Lots of rice and beans, I remember. Nothing too extravagant going on then, but Tampa, of course, had a very, very low cost of living until, I'd say, even the mid-80s. It was well below the national average. In fact, the paper regularly ran stories about how cheap it was to live here, and it really was for us at the time, thank goodness, because I don't think any of us had been able to hang in as long as we did.
I think Rob Lori ate so much spaghetti that he probably no longer includes it in his diet, you know? I mean, it's... making the rent check. I mean, there was plenty of things. Your car broke down. You never got it fixed. I had a car. I drove down. Car broke down. I just let it sit in the driveway for 6 months, you know? And it was ridiculous the way we lived. But everything went for the station, and the station was a long-term project, and the station wasn't going well. Your life wasn't going well.
The radio station, the staff found a dilapidated Victorian mansion in a rundown neighborhood west of downtown Tampa. Ed Miller recalls the first studio, where several staff members actually wound up living.
Keeping in touch with a strange karma, the entire experience, we went into a house that had previously housed all these Moonies had lived there. I mean, we walked in and there was mattresses all over the floor. The first thing we do is throw all the mattresses out because 60 people have been living there.
We went up to the second floor of this big old wood frame house, and they showed me a bedroom, and they said, well, this is going to be the station manager's office. And of course, there was nothing in there. There was a desk made out of a door, and that was it. And then they showed me a back porch, kind of a sun porch, and that was where the air studio was going to be, but all there was a big empty room. And then they showed me a bathroom next to the back porch, and they said, this is where the record library is going to be. Well, there were no records in it.
By the time early volunteers like Cheryl Mogul arrived, WMNF had started to take shape.
And it was really a funky, funky, funky joint. Dilapidated, disgusting, filthy, but it was great. It was a great place. One of the two things, I mean, I did see rats, and I've never seen rats in a building. You know, it was that dirty. There were, you know, I did see a rat in one of the offices, pretty big, about 6 inches long, and it was on a chair, you know. I'm like, oh my God. And one of the best stories, too, was this is, well, later on down the line, they had this yellow, had been yellow, it was filthy shag rug. You know, just a rug in the record library. And I was lying on the floor, just lying there, you know, head on the ground, listening to some music. And on this gross rug, I mean, it was black and, you know, filthy shag. And my eyes, you know, I'm lying on the floor and I'm telling you, my eyes looked at, and the rug was moving. It was maggots. There were maggots in the rug. It was foul. It was a foul, really gross, you know, it was like, ooh, but it was really friendly, and it was just a great place to hang out. And everyone, yeah, there's rats, I'm running. And the refrigerator downstairs, I mean, I wouldn't even go near that thing. It was like you'd walk up past the downstairs, like, you know, very, very grassroots, just funky, but it had such character. It really did. It was a great home. From reality, it just getting real. That's why I'm staying
with this real.
Acquiring permits, gathering funds, and finding a building helped create the foundation of a radio station. Yet with all this work, the frequency at 88.5 remained silent. The amount of work began to take its toll. Some volunteers left, some said they'd be back if the station ever got on the air, and more local people became involved. The project earned the support of the local press, but the public was growing impatient with the delays. A major grant was given, which helped rejuvenate the effort, but expensive broadcast equipment was a major holdup. Acquiring smaller items, microphones, turntables, tape recorders, wasn't too hard. People were generous with the obsolete and broken-down equipment cluttering their closets. But even with the grant, large amounts of cash had to be scraped together for items like a secondhand antenna and transmitter. Pioneer Joe Fox bicycled around town, visiting area radio and television stations and hoping to be taken seriously enough to rent tower space. The lack of funds still remained an obstacle.
I think our biggest frustration was paying for the equipment and getting the equipment in the first place and figuring out how to hook it together.
Waiting to scrape together enough money to buy this piece of equipment, and then we'd have to throw a benefit or canvas or, you know, get some kind of function together or wait for some other little chunk of grant money or something to come in, and then we'd be able to scrape together enough money to buy that next piece of equipment in the chain of pieces of equipment that eventually get you broadcasting.
We even hustled an engineer, a guy named Ed Costco. Ed Costco's an engineer at Honeywell, and he had put a pirate radio station on the air at WUSF.
At that time, the manager was Joe Fox, and he was acting as engineer at that time, although he didn't really have a technical background. But he and I would, he would set up appointments at local radio stations, and he and I would go to these stations and interview their chief engineers, and we were really just starting from scratch. We had no idea what we were doing at all. We would just walk in and look around and say, well, I guess we have to build up something like this.
The cost of a new antenna in 1979 ran maybe $14,000. The station had only about $1,000 to spend. What they had to do was find a used antenna already tuned to M&F's assigned frequency. Corresponding with every radio station around the country broadcasting at 88.5, they searched for an antenna about to be taken out of service. They hit pay dirt at KQED in San Francisco.
They told us they could take it out of service in, you know, 3-4 months. And I think it ended up being a year before we actually got it. Everything that we did was motivated by the fact that we had no money, and we had to save every dime we could.
With no money to hire a professional tower crew, Joe Fox decided to take the grassroots philosophy to unheard-of extremes, climbing 600 feet in the air to hang cable. He overcame his fear of heights gradually, each day working higher and higher up the tower. He then encouraged other staff members to throw caution to the wind and work with him up in the clouds.
I think the most dangerous and really outrageous effort we made was to actually pull the cable up to the 600-foot level on the tower. We put a pulley on the tower up at 600 feet, and we got a 1,200-foot rope and basically took it up the tower and ran it through that pulley and dropped it back down the tower and attached the end of the coax cable to it and just started pulling.
We used two cars. It was Kevin Rooney's car. He had an Audi, and I had saved money to buy a 71 Volvo, a two-door, no air conditioning. It wasn't fancy. It was just a basic car. And so Kevin and I took turns using our car in this field to pull up the heavy equipment and the cables.
But if you can just visualize what's going on as you drive away from the base of the tower with this line tied to the back of this car and stretching from the back of this car up to the 600-foot point on the tower where the pulley is, as you drive out away from the tower, you're more and more starting to pull on the tower, pull out rather than pull down. And we were just keeping our fingers crossed that we would never get to the point where we applied so much lateral torque to the tower that we might pull it over.
I think we were all a little naive and in some ways a little reckless, but we didn't have any choice. Either we did it ourselves or it wasn't going to get done.
For the video...
With the antenna hung and broadcast equipment in place, the early radio workers still had to wait for permission from the Federal Communications Commission to begin broadcasting. In the meantime, they tested their used and rebuilt equipment by doing air checks, short test broadcasts that varied from pounding on the equipment to testing 1, 2, 3, can you hear me? Eventually, they played every kind of music imaginable.
And we'd get on the air and say, it was kind of like, is anybody out there? Can anybody hear us? If you're within the sound of my voice, please call the following phone number. And the phone would ring, and we'd start to get an idea of how far out our signal was going. And it was like, wow, somebody in Wymoma can hear us, or somebody in Ozona called, you know. And it was just, it really, I think, brought shivers down my spine and gave us all goosebumps when we knew that the signal was going out, being received, and that people were responding. To have something finally come back from out there, you know, in the ether.
What we were supposed to be doing was broadcasting some kinds of tones and checking, I don't know, you know, guys sitting around with plastic pocket liners and equipment listening to it and adjusting the actual broadcast. But in reality, we just fired up that transmitter, cranked it on max, and started playing records.
I guess to me, probably the one of the days that I will always have sort of etched in my memory about the station, certainly one of those was the first day that we signed on the air.
Janine Farver, working for Acorn in New Orleans, joined the station's efforts the summer of 1979. She remembers sitting in another long staff meeting on September 14th.
When, you know, the postman came with a telegram that none of us really expected, and it just said something like, the FCC is giving you official notice that you can broadcast. And we sort of read it and hadn't planned for what we would do, but all of us ran back to the air studio, you know, sort of anxious to flip the switch, but we decided we didn't know what we would play or how we would deal with this sort of momentous occasion. So we started pawing through our 50 or 100 albums that we had back there. And I still remember in traditional M&F fashion, there was some argument whether we should play Stars and Stripes Forever or Fanfare for the Common Man, the Aaron Copland piece.
So I couldn't find anything else but this Stars and Stripes Forever. We had a collection of Sousa's music, so we put that on just because it was a rousing song and it was an attention grabber. So that was the first song that went on the air by default.
Community stations start out with a community and political focus and end up airing nothing but syndicated shows. Steeped in activism, WMNF's founders kept the vision of a community-based station promoting alternative political, social, and musical viewpoints.
WMNF was born out of a kind of a different style than a lot of community radio stations, where it was people who felt there were certain gaps in the musical programming on the radio dial and wanted to fill them. I think we had a much bigger mission and tried to include many more types of people than most public radio stations do. We really wanted senior citizens, people from different minority communities, women, all the people who have not traditionally been part of the media. We worked hard to make sure they were here at WMNF. So I think it immediately started us out differently from a lot of community radio stations around the country, and I think has really continued to make this a different kind of station.
WMNF is a community-supported radio station. While the staff worked long and hard to put it on the air, credit goes to the listeners for making it what it is today. It started with the 25,000 Tampa Bay Area residents who signed a petition supporting the creation of WMNF in 1978 and donated more than $24,000 during the canvassing drive. After going on the air in 1979, financial and moral support came pouring in and have increased every year. The station has left the old Victorian mansion, and it's grown so much that it's now expanding its current home. WMNF operates at 70,000 watts 24 hours a day, with a staff of 10 and several hundred volunteers. The record library is no longer in the bathroom. Thanks for listening to the story of how WMNF got on the air. This program was produced by Bill George, Sheila Daughtry, and Twyla Huda. Cassette copies are available by calling 813-238-8001 during business hours. This show is a production of WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, Florida.
Well, that is a vintage documentary about the founding of WMNF, and Sheila Calley produced that when she was working here. That's probably 20 or 25 years old. We heard in there Joe Fox and Ed Costco, Ed Miller, Cam Dilley, Cheryl Mogul, Janine Farber, Arnie Schlansky, all in that documentary, among the early people here at WMNF. I'm going to open up the phone lines and ask you, what got you hooked on WMNF? How did you discover WMNF? We went on the air officially on September 14th, 1979, and this Saturday is our official 40th birthday. But how did you discover WMNF? Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. I think one of the stories that's left out of that doc, and that's a great documentary, is the fact that in 1975, students at the University of South Florida had student-run programming about 8 hours a day on WUSF. It was mostly rock and roll. There was a lot of Allman Brothers and a lot of Grateful Dead and Jamie Brockett and other people on Underground Railroad. But the new president of the University of South Florida in 1975, a guy named Cecil Mackey, came in and decided to change the nature of the radio station from partially student-run. Students paid a lot of money in their student services fee to keep WUSF on the air. And President Mackey took most of the student programming off the air in 1975. If you go back and look at the USF Oracle, you'll see that there were big protests on campus in 75, and Arnie Schlansky had transferred from Antioch down to USF in 1975 and went to one of his professors at USF and said, you know, if I start a radio station here, will you give me credit? And the professor kind of laughed and said, sure, I will. And you heard Arnie say that he worked 3 years on the project and then turned it over to Joe Fox. But that's part of the backstory about WMNF, the big student protests on the USF campus over the taking away of their radio station. Well, again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. I like how Sheila said in that documentary that we moved to a rundown neighborhood just west of downtown. And at the time it was, but that rundown neighborhood is Hyde Park, where it's no longer run down. And the building that we were in at 305 South Boulevard eventually burned down. And it's been replaced by a lawyer's office that's in the same spot where we were. I posted this yesterday on Facebook that I was going to play this documentary. And I asked people, do you remember what caused you to become a fan of MNF? And I'll just read the first three or four posts. John said, you came to my door and I gave you $5 in 1978, John says. And Miles said, love MNF, the best radio station on the planet. Maggie says, the birth of MNF was also the birth of my understanding that I was surrounded by a big, thriving community of like-minded folks. What a wonderful revelation that was. DeAndre says, outside of schooling, there was near zero quality social engagement for me out here. Then I found MNF. You guys saved my mind, writes DeAndre. And Andrew writes, moved from Oregon, found you all, and felt less alone. Shelley writes, I came to Tampa from the Northeast in 1985. When I found MNF, I found my people, and I realized I could be at home here. Well, let's talk about how did you discover MNF and what got you hooked on the radio station? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. You can also email the station, the air studio here at dj@wmnf.org. And you are listening to Radioactivity on WMNF. And, you know, one of the other questions, too, is do you have a favorite theme song from the past that any of our hosts used to use? Let's go to Emil in Tampa. Emil, thanks for calling in. What's your MNF story?
Yeah, I used to live over on 32nd Avenue, and I came home from Hillsborough High School one time, and I was coming down Virginia Street, and I came upon a sign, and there was a Methodist church, and in front of it was Duval's funeral home. And it's a community radio, and a guy brought me in and showed me around, and it was just pretty neat because apparently it had just started. And
yeah, that was our second location. We had moved from 305 South Boulevard to 3838 Nebraska, right behind the United Methodist Church in Nebraska. At that corner now, that's where a Winn-Dixie is right now. But we used to be in that block that turned into the Winn-Dixie.
But I thought it was pretty neat because I didn't understand what community radio, and a gentleman showed me around, and
And what got you hooked? What was it? Was it just the tour of the station that got you hooked?
I would imagine the different format.
Yeah, the different format. Yeah. All right. Well, Emil, thanks a lot. You're a long timer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Emil. And let's go to Marianne in Seminole. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, Rob. Yes, I was a student at USF, and a classmate told me about the wonderful concerts at Skipper's. So that's how I met.
Do you remember your first MNF concert at Skipper's? Do you remember the first band you saw?
No, I was so busy studying, I guess. But I saw most of your concerts, so the music really got me hooked, and then I became a member shortly after. That must have been about 82 or 81, I can't remember.
Well, thank you for that. Thank
and
you.
I love all the public affairs and everything. I think it's the most wonderful thing that happened to Tampa area.
Oh, that's nice
thank
of you to
so
say.
Much.
Thanks, Marianne. Okay. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're going to go to Bill in Jacksonville. Bill, what's your earliest memory of MNF?
Hello, WMNF family. This is Bill in Jacksonville. I was 10 years old, and I was playing hooky from school. Mommy, my tummy hurts. I can't. And some hippie comes to the door with a coffee can saying he wants to start a radio station. I went and pilfered all the coinage I could find from my sister, who always had plenty of money, and my father from his dresser drawer. And I put, I don't know, it might have been about 10 bucks or so in the jar. That was my first experience with WMNF. And since then, I have attended many lectures from Nader to Greg Palace to Jim Hightower, many different concerts. But the public affairs, first of all, it was the music, blues and reggae and just the various types of music that you would play. And then the lectures and the public affairs really just, I haven't been able to tune out ever since. And I look forward to seeing everybody at the birthday party. My puppy and I will both be there.
All right. Well, Bill, thanks a lot. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking your sister and your dad's money. That was nice of you.
Oh, yeah. If my sister ever knew at the time, she would have beat my butt.
Okay. Bill, thanks a lot. I hope it wasn't a whole lot. I hope it didn't prevent her from making her car payment. Sarah writes this, music from the aisles, bluegrass, and executive session. That's what finally hooked me, writes Sarah. She's in Arcadia. And David writes, I first started listening to MNF during my lunch break in Sarasota 20 years ago while working at Pineapple Press. And I became a regular listener to Radioactivity, writes David. Thank you for that. 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. And we're asking you what was it that hooked you on WMNF? Also asking, how did you discover MNF? And do you have a favorite theme song that's been used by one of the hosts over the years? We're going to go to Mark in Riverview. He says he was part of the Tower crew. Hey, Mark, how are you?
Doing very well.
So you're out there in Riverview. You know, we always kept it a secret from Channel 13 that we used our cars to pull up the antenna and the cable. We used the Channel 13's auxiliary tower, and I think had they heard that we were doing it ourselves without a tower crew, they would have stopped our project immediately. But we got away with it.
Here was the deal. I was 16. It was in 77. I just graduated from Brennan High School. We were over there painting one of my buddy's old 62 Falcon. And here comes this old Volvo and some dudes with a rope. We didn't know what the hell they were doing, and they scared the crap out of us.
And rightly so. It was a crazy endeavor.
We were freaking out, I'm telling you.
Yeah. All right, Mark, thanks a lot.
Oh, and that's not what brought me to working, listening to it. I was over there at the school over there on Orient Road, the Titans, whatever that is over there, and I'm in my buddy 69 Cuda. He's showing off in front of some girl, revs it up to about $4,000 and drops the thing down in drive and blows the crap out of the transmission. The radio did not work in the car. The radio came on, and it was your radio station and it was the radio on your station there, and that's how we found out about this place.
So it just came on magically, yeah?
It came on just like poof, out
how
of
about
the blue. I swear to God, we could not believe that one.
The magic of M&F.
That's the end of that.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. Let's go to Karen in Seminole. Hey, Karen.
Hi. So it was the week after 9/11, and all my equipment was gone in World Trade 2, and I found out my dad had cancer. And I said, well, what am I going to do? I guess I'm going to just go to Florida. So I packed everything up, and the radio stations, of course, were all full of all the horrible news and everything. And I listened to the low end of the dial all the way driving to Florida, and I got here and I looked for the station I used to listen to when I was a kid, which was the old WUSF with all the great hippie music and all the space music on at night that I used to listen to in the late 60s and early 70s.
Yeah, that was Underground Railroad.
Yeah, exactly. And I found the, I found the new USF, and it, you know, it has its talents, of course. But then I kept fooling around down there, and I found you guys, and I practically wept when I heard Amy Goodman and Radioactivity, and I just felt like I had come, like, full circle, and I was so glad. I really appreciate you guys.
Wow, we're glad you're there. So, Karen, you lost all your stuff in 9/11.
All my equipment was up on the 92nd floor.
Wow.
Of World Trade 2.
Could I ask what kind of equipment or what do you do for a living?
It was IT work. It was a microwave.
Wow. Wow. Well, Karen, I'm glad you weren't part of that terrible day. At least you weren't a victim personally.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Karen, thanks a lot. I'm glad you found us. We're talking about the early days of WMNF because this Saturday is our official 40th birthday. The birthday celebration is sold out at the Coliseum. There might be some scalpers there. I don't know. But let's go to Jay in Sarasota. Jay, how'd you get hooked on MNF, Jay?
Well, I used to be a real mainstream radio listener, and I tune all over the place to see what's on. And of course, I would hear WMNF, and I thought, well, that's pretty good. But you know, then I'd go back and forth and back and forth. And then they talked about, well, you know, you can come and volunteer for a fundraiser. And I thought, okay, I'll sign up. So they had an opening with the women's show, and so I went and volunteered for that, and it was so much fun. The people were nice, the volunteers were nice, everything was great. And so I decided, well, I'll do that again sometime. And then as I was listening on Saturdays and what have you, this plea got in my ear and really hooked me, because I had never heard such great music from a plea before. And so then the next time I came and volunteered, I volunteered for his show. And everything about the station. Oh, and I didn't used to be a news person at all, but now the public affairs, as I've listened more and more, had hooked me. So I, you know, of course, I love both, and just have been a WMNF person ever since.
Oh wow! So the women's show. Wow, you must have gone way back when there was a kind of a collective of women that were doing the show,
The two. It was mainly the two, but yeah. Arlene and Mary.
And Mary. Okay. So that was that era. All right, Jay. Who knew Flea could make such great music? Who knew a Flea could make such great music? Huh?
You know, and it was funny because people were in the, you know, because I think Flea came on right after the women's show then or something. But anyway, people were there to volunteer for Flea, and it was just a whole different world. Oh, and one more thing. Flea, the first time I volunteered for him years ago, had a grab bag of gifts for his people that were volunteering, and this was in the 90s.
Yeah.
And so I picked a little lizard gecko type of thing and put it on the dashboard of my car, and ever since, every car I ever have, and I'm sitting in it right now looking at it, I have had that little lizard on my dashboard.
That's great. Well, Flea's always a very generous guy. I'm glad you and he hooked up. Jay, thanks a lot.
Oh, we did. Thank you.
Thanks. And Diallo writes this: I was strolling through the dial and could not believe my ears. I heard rap music. I've been a fan ever since. Long live Kenny K. Yeah, the first, perhaps the first rap program on local radio, at least on FM, was Kenny K's Late Night Saturday Show. And Diallo, thanks for remembering the great Kenny K. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're talking about how people discovered us. Some people are pretty new to the station. Some people have been listening practically since the start. Let's go to Ron in Lakeland. Hey, Ron, you're on.
Good morning. Thank you. I first became addicted to the Left Side of the Dial when I lived in Pittsburgh. Growing up, I listened to WYEP, which was underground radio you mentioned a few minutes ago. And I spent a couple of years as a classical DJ at WDUQ-FM. Moved to Florida in 86, Orlando, but every time I came over to the West Coast, there was like this really cool radio going on, so we'd come in and out. Then when I moved to Polk County in 99, you guys were my home, and you're my lifeline here. You're my savior.
Oh, that's great. It's interesting because I have a good friend that used to work at WYEP in the 70s. His name was Mark Cohen. And Mark moved from Pittsburgh to Yellow Springs, Ohio, where I was working. And he became the news director there in the mid-1970s. But I remember, I had friends at YEP way back in the 70s.
Yes, we would listen to it late at night on our bedrooms when our parents were asleep and listen to all the stuff we weren't allowed to hear otherwise.
That's right. That's right.
My identity with WMNF was back when I started working for Polk County in 99. I was living in Orlando and commuting here, and I couldn't pick it up until Route 27 on I-4. And then I'd lose it in Winter Haven. But since then, you've made tower changes. I can get you guys all the way up into Disney now.
I know, it's terrific.
I get you out in Lake Placid.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. We got those listeners in Sebring and Arcadia, too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But a band that really connected me to you guys was the Iguana.
Oh,
and
what
I remember
a great band.
Heat Wave, you brought them to Heat Wave one year, and the power went out on that stage, and they were not able to play till like 1:30 or 1:45 in the morning. And my wife damn near divorced me for making her stay that long to hear the Iguanas.
Was it worth the stay?
Our 28th anniversary in December.
So you're still together. All right. Ron, thanks a lot. Great stories. All right. And let's go to Robin. Let's go to Robin Thanota Sassa. Hey, Rob, what's your earliest memory of MNF?
Well, you know, it sort of was a slow introduction. I remember going to the location where you were in Nebraska, and I don't know if I just dropped by out of curiosity because I'd started listening, or I don't think I knew anyone at that time, but I remember really thinking how great this was that you could run a station on this sort of in this low-key way. And I remember Cheryl Mogul's show and also the rap show with Kenny K, right? And I just thought that was so interesting, but I didn't really become a super dedicated listener until I started listening to Jenny Juristo's show After the Polka.
Oh, yeah, on Sunday afternoons. That was a great show.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, that's where I just began to be turned on to so much music that was right at my ballpark, you know, that I never would have heard. And from then on, I started going to Heat Wave, and, you know, ever since then, I've been a supporter. But I do remember that. When were you guys at that location? What period in Nebraska?
We moved there in about 81 or 82, and we stayed there until 89.
89, yeah. So right, it would be around in the mid-80s. But, yeah, so it wasn't like I was all in, but, you know, because I had started listening to, the Garrison Keillor show on 89.7. So I was becoming more and more aware of this other kind of radio where people spoke in normal tones and they weren't yelling at you all the time. And I just thought that, too, was like a big change. I said, I didn't know radio could be like this. So, yeah, it was great.
That's a beautiful thing. Rob, thanks a lot.
All right.
Well, we're almost out of time, and I hate to try to squeeze in anybody more. Andrea writes this: a friend of mine introduced me to your radio station 15 years ago. I've been hooked ever since. I especially love the talk, but I always find new and interesting music, mostly local and or folk. I might have read talk wrong, but I think that's what she printed there. Anyway, that's Andrea in Safety Harbor. Andrea, thank you. Well, remember, the birthday bash this Saturday night is sold out, but we're going to be celebrating MNF for the entire weekend, playing great specials for you. So keep your dial tuned to 88.5 FM. I was asking people about favorite theme songs, too. One of my favorite theme songs from MNF was Ron Davis on Saturday night used to do a jazz show. He was a FAMU graduate and just did one of the great jazz shows overnight on Saturday night. And this was his theme song, Eddie Harris, More Soul Than Soulful. We're going to go out with it. Thanks a lot for listening. Stay tuned for a discussion about reviving the Equal Rights Amendment. This is WMNF in Tampa.